Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. In no particular order on the program today, our series I've Always Wondered. We've got some healthcare and energy policy news for you, although not in the same story. And also a chat with Fred Savage. Yes, that's Fred Savage. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday it is, the 28th day of September. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It has been a busy day in the land of business and economics. You got stocks once again introducing us to their old friend, volatility. An American industrial bellwether, the Aluminum Company of America, Alcoa, as it's also known, is splitting itself in two to cut the drag from its dragging commodities business. And Royal Dutch Shell has thrown in the towel on what might be the most expensive oil well ever. The company has put $7 billion into Arctic exploration all in, but announced this morning it didn't find enough oil and gas to make it worthwhile right now, and that for the foreseeable future, Alaskan Arctic fossil fuels are going to stay in the ground. There is a complicated dance going on between the economics of Arctic oil and the realities of climate change. And a new study out today in the lead-up to the big climate conference in Paris at the end of the year says that total climate pledges already made are still going to warm things up too much. Marketplace's Scott Tong starts us off from the Sustainability Desk.
Shell's is not the only Arctic fail this year. Stephen Kopitz at Princeton Energy Advisors says drilling in the Russian Arctic is also on hold, as well as in the waters above Norway.
Right now, the Arctic is shut down effectively. You know, these oil prices do not support Arctic exploration and drilling, anywhere in the world right now.
When oil prices go back up, big oil may return. The thing is, that collides head-on with the idea of a carbon budget. That is, to keep the planet's warming under 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and right now we're on course for 6, just a fixed amount of fossil fuels can be burned. Economist Paul Ekins at University College London modeled what that might look like. He assumed that markets decide where to drill.
That is, you burn the cheapest resources first, and you leave the rest in the ground. And a notable result was that we didn't burn any Arctic resources at all.
The point is, Arctic drilling is remote and expensive. The question is how to stay away from it when oil prices rise. And the answer? Don't let them rise, says environmental scientist Steve Davis at the University of California, Irvine.
I often describe this problem as a cookie jar that we have to walk past for the rest of human civilization without dipping our hand in.
For cookie monsters, that's impossible. Unless, of course, a tastier treat arrives. And for Davis, that's renewable energy, enough to push down demand for fossil fuels and thus the price. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Speaking of price, on now to healthcare. What you and I might call a nasty case of the flu, your doctor might call a nasty case of a 487.1. Every illness, every ailment and injury, every procedure has a code, a standardized code, so the providers and insurers can be sure they are speaking the same language when it comes to paying the bills. There are 14,000 of those codes in all, which sounds like a lot until you learn that this Wednesday, there are going to be 70,000 of them. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on this coming update to the coding system and all the money behind it.
When it comes to the new codes, the buck stops with Sean Cavanaugh. He runs Medicare.
The medical codes we use for diagnosis and billing haven't been updated for over 35 years.
Cavanaugh says we're missing a lot of detail right now.
For instance, we recently had a threat of a problem with Ebola, and the current set does not have a code that's specific to Ebola.
The new, more detailed codes Medicare put out will be adopted by the whole healthcare system. They'll be important for the transition to a new way of paying doctors and hospitals, for results rather than procedures. Important because they'll answer this crucial question.
How sick is your population?
That's Farzad Mostashari. Until a couple of years ago, he was in charge of coordinating the nation's health information technologies. Now he's a consultant. He says once we answer that question, we'll know how good a job a doctor is doing in getting patients healthy. And that will help with the ultimate goal.
To have them share in the savings if you take better care of the patient and if they end up costing the system less.
That's long-term. Short-term, the codes might also help hospitals and others bill certain insurers for additional ailments, bringing in more money. But there are lots of snickers about the new codes getting too specific, like ones that differentiate between an alligator bite versus a crocodile bite. Medicare's Sean Kavanaugh says most doctors will only need to learn some of the new codes.
If they don't have crocodiles and alligators in their community, they don't need to worry about those codes.
In other words, sorry, doctors in Florida. You're out of luck. I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
And also, do you care whether it's an alligator or a crocodile bite? Come on. All right, the aforementioned volatility on Wall Street today led nowhere good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When one thinks of sports, one doesn't necessarily think of a bunch of guys sitting around typing on a computer, even if they do wind up at the end typing quite furiously. But it seems competitive coding, the sport of coding, is a thing, writing computer programs in pursuit of a prize. Ashley Vance wrote about it in Bloomberg Business Week. Ashley, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sport of coding. You're going to have to tell me how those two things go together, man, because it just, I don't know.
Yeah, this is a backwater for technology. You know, there's these contests where people basically are programming for speed. The sort of rules vary, but you have this time limit and you have to solve as many of these puzzles as you can with code that runs quickly and accurately, and you're trying to beat all the other competitors to get this done.
I am paraphrasing here, but only loosely. You say this is roughly about as exciting as watching paint dry.
You know, the actual thing, the actual contest is not that exciting. Right. I went to this event called the Facebook Hacker Cup at their headquarters, and they say sort of, ready, set, code, and then the entire room falls deadly silent like a library, and the first few minutes of the contest are just people reading the problem, sort of picking which one they're going to do, and so it's very quiet, and then eventually, about 10 minutes or so into the contest, you get some click-clack on the keyboards. As the event goes on, though, it gets a little more interesting because people start to freak out and you can sort of get a sense as to who's doing well and who's really struggling.
The winner of I think, the Facebook Hacker Cup that you profiled in there, he got like $10,000. But really, it's not about the money, right? It's about the opportunities and the jobs that come from being really good at maybe the most fundamental thing in this economy today.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of it. So the guy who won, he's a Belarusian. His name is Gennady, but he goes by Tourist online. Right. And he's kind of the Roger Federer of sport coding. He hardly ever loses. And, you know, he probably makes about $250,000 a year from these. So he does all right. The rest of the competitors, for the most part, it's a way to have bragging rights and to show that you're good at this skill. And yeah, I ran across people who were 18 years old and they are getting job offers from all of Silicon Valley's top companies in countries like Russia and China. This is a very prestigious type of thing, and you would get money from the government. You would get automatic entrance into any university you wanted if you really excel at these things.
Well, let me ask you the nationalistic question then. Is there a U.S. support system so that we perhaps can play in this game, I guess?
This is one of the more interesting things I found doing the story. So back, this sort of started in the 1970s, and it came out of a U.S. academic environment, and the U.S. was very, very good and did very well. Over the last decade, the story has been almost completely about China and Russia, and the U.S. has, it's a very informal support structure. Basically, you go for this university sort of a training course for about 2 weeks if you're in, say, the top 10. And, you know, I thought Google, Facebook, Microsoft, all the big tech companies would be sponsoring this stuff, but they really don't. It's kind of smaller Wall Street firms that I found as the sponsors for this training.
Who are probably hiring most of these folks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Wall Street seems to have cottoned on to this a little bit earlier even than Silicon Valley did, which is kind of funny. I think it's because the nature of the problems and what these people are good at, which is they might not be coming up with some breakthrough in artificial intelligence, for example. Right. But if you need, you know, some problem solved quickly, you need someone who works well on a team, this is kind of the person that you want. These are real world skills for sure.
Ashley Vance, he writes on sport coding in Bloomberg Business Week. Ashley, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Coming up.
Well, I'm not Daniel Day-Lewis. I'm not going to go live in the woods and learn how to, you know, use an axe.
But it'd be cool if he did, right? Fred Savage, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. You knew it was coming, right? The Dow off 312 points, hence the Wawa trombones. 1.9% on the blue chips closed at 16,001. The NASDAQ off 142 points, 3%, 45.43. The S&P 500 dropped 49 points, 2.5%, 1881. The energy sector felt the heat today on that Royal Dutch Shell news. Shell burned 2.6% lower. Exxon declined 0.8%. Shares in the Swiss company Glencore fell on fears about the mining and commodities trading company's debt. Glencore stock off nearly 30% today. Alcoa, on the other hand, up 5.7%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury rose to 2.09%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is no shortage of news out of the nation's capital, where, with soon-to-be former Speaker of the House John Boehner on the way out, a deal appears to be in the offing to keep the government running for another couple of months anyway. It is yet another reminder, not that we necessarily needed one, that the way business gets done in Washington these days is in fits and starts. There are, of course, consequences to this lack of long-term or even medium-term planning. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer starts with health care policy and works her way out from there.
Congress used to do a little dance each year. It was called the Doc Fix. Every year, doctors treating Medicare patients faced a big pay cut until Congress passed a fix. Mixed in with the fix, funding for other Medicare expenses like physical therapy and ambulance rides. But there's no fix this year.
It really affects providers across the board.
Tristan North is a lobbyist at the American Ambulance Association. He says he was happy when Congress actually passed a permanent fix for doctors, locking in yearly raises. But funding for those other Medicare expenses, like $100 million for ambulance rides, wasn't locked in. That left North scrambling.
There's a lot that Congress needs to address between now and the end of the year.
No kidding. Members of Congress have to pass a budget, a bunch of tax credits are expiring, oh, and they have to deal with the debt ceiling.
Well, everything in Washington these days, when it's done at all, is done on a temporary basis.
Howard Gleckman is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute.
We pass tax legislation that lasts a year at a time. We do highway bills for 3 months at a time.
Gleckman says partisanship is the main reason for this piecemeal budgeting, but there's another reason, too, according to Jack Pitney, a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College.
Members of Congress keep issues alive so that interest groups will keep campaign coffers full.
Pitney says lobbyists who have to fight for funding every year have to keep up the campaign contributions to get the votes they need. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There's a better than even chance that you're in your car right now, passing road sign after road sign as you make your way about your afternoon. Those signs do a lot for us, you know. They point us in the right direction. They tell us when to stop and what to watch out for. And today they direct us to the latest installment of our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blatant.
We've got a twofer this week. Similar questions from both Chris Achiu of Snoqualmie, Washington, and Kellen McGuire here in Los Angeles, who asked this.
I've always wondered where freeway signs come from.
Good thing for him, Marketplace's Mark Garrison has the answer.
I'm standing in front of a sign in North Carolina for 98 East. We're very close to the birthplace of nearly all North Carolina road signs. It's a very unusual factory, and chances are the highway signs you drive by every day came from a place like it.
Three visitors.
The gate rumbles open to a factory with heavy security. Layers of fencing topped with coils of serious-looking razor wire. There's a looming watchtower and no-nonsense guards everywhere. This plant is inside a medium-security prison east of Raleigh. As in many states, nearly all of North Carolina's road signs are made by inmates. After multiple security screenings, we cross the gravel prison yard and enter the sign plant. It's an enormous space. In one corner, an inmate feeds a square piece of metal through a heavy-duty machine, chopping each corner to make the familiar octagonal shape of a stop sign. The first thing you feel is just how big the signs actually are. They don't look so huge from a driver's seat. Interstate signs are gigantic, like movie screens.
This is an exit sign for... I-40 east to Greensboro.
Prisoners work under state officials like plant manager Danny Stanley. He watches as the sign is hoisted high in the air while a worker shines a spotlight and peers carefully.
Danny scratches and he can see it behind that light. If there's anything else wrong with it, the color varies or anything, he can also see that.
Did this one pass?
That one passed. It's going out the door.
Another striking thing is what the prisoners work with. Utility knives, drills, they're tools, but also potential deadly weapons in the hands of convicted killers formerly in maximum security. Phil Rowe explains how they earn the plant's trust.
They want a job, and they've been infraction-free in order to achieve the job.
Rowe oversees this plant and other facilities for Correction Enterprises, North Carolina's prison labor agency. With nearly $100 million in annual sales and thousands of inmates at work, it's one of the largest state prison labor operations in America. Leaders are quick to point out it works without taxpayer money. Inmates like Stephen Good say they never knew where signs came from.
No, I had no idea, none whatsoever. It was an experience to come in here and actually see signs being made and knowing I'm going to be a part of signs on the road now. Yeah.
Like that train whistle Johnny Cash sang about, the signs remind them of the world beyond the walls. When prisoners imagine what it would be like to see them out there, they sound like Charles Austin.
They want to say, welcome to North Carolina. That's one of the big things we do here. I might tell my grandkids I helped put that sign on the road.
There's pride in creating these signs, but little money. 26 cents an hour is top pay. Studies show vocational training like prisoners get here makes them more likely to find work and less likely to fall back into crime. But prison labor is also controversial for paying low wages and crowding out private companies that have to offer free market salaries.
Away from the noise of the plant, Good talks about what kind of job he might get on the outside with his new skills and what it would be like to drive by a sign he made.
You know, you see something that you had a part in, and it'll give you a good feeling. But, I mean, until I actually do it, I can't really say how it'll make me feel. But I know it'll be a good feeling, though.
He's being optimistic, maybe justifiably. He was once on death row for first-degree murder. A judge saved his life, ruling Good had ineffective counsel, but he still faces life in prison.
It's a thing that you stay in the courts and you fight, and you try to just do your best to make this time go by. I don't see myself doing all that time, but hopefully we can see me in the next 5 years looking at the signs.
Next time you drive by one of those signs, think about who made it. They may not see it for years. In North Carolina, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We can't do this segment without you, you know. I mean, we could, but then it would be we've always wondered, and who wants that? So please, send us your questions. There's a place you can do it at our website, marketplace.org. Fred Savage spent the first part of his career as an actor. You might know him best from the TV series The Wonder Years, or maybe one of the best movies ever, in my humble opinion, The Princess Bride. But for the past decade or so, he's been making a name for himself as a producer and a director. That is perfectly happy to be off camera. On the theory, though, that you never know what tomorrow will bring, he's got a new TV show. It's called The Grinder. He co-stars with Rob Lowe as a small-town lawyer, and it premieres tomorrow night. Fred, thanks for coming into the studio.
It's a pleasure. We're big fans, so it's very nice to meet you.
Well, and I'm a fan of yours, too, and we'll get to that later.
All right, good.
We were talking before we turned the microphones on.
Yes.
About the Directors Guild and the Emmys and all this.
Yeah.
And you have to go because you're on the board and all this stuff. You've done directing.
Yes.
You are an actor.
Yes.
You're a producer.
Uh-huh.
Which do you like better?
Honestly, I like that all. I know that's such a bogus answer, but I really do. I mean, I have been working in the TV business since I was 6 years old. I was an actor for a long time, and I always wanted to be a director, and I went and I worked really hard, and I kind of built that career up, and that turned into producing and directing. And then this acting, this new acting gig on this new show was not part of the plan, came out of the clear blue sky, and so now I'm doing that.
Is it true you turned it down three times?
Well, I didn't turn it down three times.
Did you defer, maybe?
I totally deferred. Right. So a friend of mine, who our daughters are in school together, yeah. He's like, I have this great script, you should read it. So I read it. I'm like, oh my God, this is fantastic. It's hysterical. And I said, I'd love to direct it. Let's do it. He goes, oh no, this is for you to act. I was like, oh no, that's not in the cards for me. I kind of left that, you know, behind. He goes, well, just consider it. And I was like, I said, we're going to know each other for a long time. You know, like our daughters are in first grade.
So let's not mess it up.
Yeah. So like, what's the best way for me to say no? Like, what's the least painful way? Like, I don't want to be a jerk about it. He's like, well, come and meet the guy. So I went and I met with him and the guys who wrote it and the director, and it all worked out. And now the fact that I get to spend even more time collaborating with and working with this group of guys who I really, really like and feel really comfortable with, I couldn't be more thrilled.
When you are acting after having now directed for a while,
mm-hmm.
and you're the director of whatever you're in is putting you through your paces.
Yeah.
Do you ever think to yourself, I would do that differently, but all right, you're in charge.
You know, I very gladly and willingly and surprisingly easily turn that
off. Do you really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I feel like, you know, when you go in as an actor, your the breadth of your responsibility is very limited compared to a director. Mm-hmm, I need to be on time. I need to know my lines.
Right.
I need to hit my mark. And like not be a jerk. Like those are kind of the four big pillars. And, you know, as a director, you're worried about so many things, not just what you have to do, but you're worried about the actors and the camera and the wardrobe and the sets and the lighting and later on the editing. And there's such a breadth of responsibility and oversight that you have to have over every department that to just focus on one little thing and really dive deep into it, it's very it's really engaging and it's kind of relaxing.
I'm going to ask you a process question here. And the root of it is this. I've got this rule that says if you think about how you sound when you're on the radio, while you're on the radio, you're going to mess up how you sound on the radio.
Yes.
Right?
Totally.
So Not when you're directing.
Is that why you told me not to wear headphones?
Yeah, that's right.
Because I'm not a professional.
Yeah, well, we don't let amateurs.
I get it.
Watch the Obama video. We didn't let him hold his own microphone.
I'm in good company, though. All right, good.
Not when you're directing, right? Because clearly you have to engage mentally when you're directing. But when you're acting, are you thinking or are you just doing?
You know, that's the key to everything, is to not think about it too much.
I'm completely validated.
For
the record, I get a lot of grief about my theory, but
you're completely right. There's all these little things that you try and do to immerse yourself as much as possible. I mean, look, I'm doing a comedy, a half hour comedy on TV. Right. I'm not.
It's not rocket science.
Well, I'm not Daniel Day-Lewis. I'm not going to go live in the woods and learn how to use an axe.
Right.
But that, from learning your line, which is a very basic thing, to what Daniel Day-Lewis does, all those contribute to trying to clear as much of yourself out of your head and just kind of forget the way you sound and the way you act and what you're doing with your hands. And it's very difficult.
Just because you brought him up and that idea of the big dramatic part, do you have any interest in stretching yourself beyond comedy and sort of what you've made your name in?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I think you always – look, I had no interest in doing a television show right. 2 months ago, so who knows? I mean,
don't say that out loud, man. They're listening.
I have no idea. No, they know. I mean, they know. Whatever you do in any creative endeavor, you want to try and stretch yourself. So, right now doing this show, it's a comedy and that's what I've been doing for a long time. But just going back and doing that again and trying to forget what I sound like, right, as you pointed out, that's enough for me right now. I think, if we continue doing that and I'll start to itch and maybe I will want to go live out in the woods and learn how to use an axe. But for right now, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. And this is total proof that. Don't make any plans. Don't say never. Don't do it. Just stay open and, say yes when things come along.
Fred Savage. It's called The Grinder. His new show is. It's tomorrow night on Fox. 8:30 is the time slot. Fred, thanks a lot for coming in.
It's a real pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, tax policy Donald Trump style. The Republican frontrunner released a tax plan today. The broad outlines are pretty well known by now, I imagine. Cuts in the top tax rates for personal and corporate filers, getting rid of the alternative minimum tax and the estate tax. Hedge funds would pay more in taxes, assuming this thing ever happens. Also, this, individuals making less than $25,000 or couples less than $50,000. They pay nothing and they get, and this is a quote from the release, a new one-page form to send to the IRS saying, I win. You can blame China. You could blame Janet Yellen, probably. You could blame commodities. I don't know. Either way, the Dow off 312 points today, 1.9%. The NASDAQ down 142. That is 3%. The S&P 500 dropped 49 points, 2.5%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.